Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for August 20th, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, tracking subsurface oil plumes from the Gulf spill, a fast-acting antidepressant, and a decade of open access in scientific publishing. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how faithfulness is evolutionarily advantageous from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
According to the United States government, the Deepwater Horizon blowout led to the release of an estimated 4.9 million barrels of oil in the Gulf of Mexico, the largest oil spill in U.S. history. While the cleanup process is still underway at the surface and along the coasts, oil plumes deep below the surface aren't receiving that attention because they are expected to degrade naturally. And that's because chemical dispersants released at the wellhead broke up globs of the crude oil into microscopic droplets that are more readily devoured by microbes. But as Rich Camilli, Chris Reddy, and colleagues report in a paper published online by Science, there's not a lot of oxygen that far down, neither naturally in the water nor in the oil plume, oxygen that microbes need to live. For 10 days in late June, the researchers tracked one deepwater plume that was a kilometer down, over 35 kilometers long, 200 meters tall, 2 kilometers wide, and traveling southwest. I spoke with Camilli and Reddy, both of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Here's Rich Camilli.
We measured it out to 35 kilometers from the well site before we were actually chased off from our survey operations by Hurricane Alex. So we think it extends quite a bit further, or at least at that time it extended quite a bit further, but we were unable to continue our operations because of the hurricane. The way that we measured it was using two platforms, as we call them, one being an autonomous underwater vehicle, and that was operated with a payload mass spectrometer, an underwater mass spectrometer, that measured key indicator hydrocarbon peaks. And we also used another platform, the ship itself, and it was equipped with a CTD rosette. CTD stands for conductivity, temperature, and depth. Those are the standard sensors that are put on this cable-lowered platform that makes vertical profiles into the water column. And that was also equipped with a mass spectrometer and a special kind of sample bottle called a GoFloat. And those bottles collected physical water samples based on what the mass spectrometer readings were. And then we brought those bottles back up to the surface. And Chris can explain a little bit in terms of what was done then.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yes. So once we collected these water samples in collaboration with NOAA, the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, as part of their damage assessment program, we were able to get the samples off the boat within a couple of days, and they were picked up by another boat and sent back to land and then analyzed. And some of the initial data that points to the fact that this plume contained significantly above background amounts of some hydrocarbons. But it's really important to point out that we don't know how much of the original oil that came out of the riser pipe, you know, the oil is made up of thousands of different compounds. How much of these compounds decided to say, hey, let's go into the plume versus, hey, let's go to the surface? And that's something that we'll be working on in the next couple months. But at this point, we certainly can see that there's a plume of some hydrocarbons, and hopefully we'll be able to constrain that more in the future as to why they went into the plume instead of up to the surface.
And Chris, you mentioned this was significantly higher than background rates. By plume then, what do you mean? What's the density? Is it like a river of oil or more like a cloud?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. And in fact, both Rich and I and our colleagues debated at length about what is a plume and a definition of a plume. I'm going to talk to you about it visually. Visually, these water samples look like clean spring water and had no smell. That doesn't mean that they're not harmful. It's just that, you know, the perception that this plume is a river of chocolate syrup flying across at 1,100 meters is not true. How you define what a plume is something that's better suited for our colleague, Rich Camilli.
Rich?
Okay, so the way that we define a plume is we define it as a localized maximum within the water column when we were doing these, for example, the vertical profiles with the CTD rosette. the sensors had to encounter a localized maximum where the maximum concentration of whatever hydrocarbons we were tracking, in this case multiple hydrocarbons, they had to have a concentration that was more than two standard deviations above what the baseline was. So that was true for the vertical profiling and for the horizontal profiling with the AUV. So pretty straightforward statistical definition of an anomaly, and we use that to define the spatial location of the plume.
If I can add,
Chris.
One thing it's important to add, that it's a big difference between many observations of subsurface concentrations of oil being found, and I don't dispute that, you know, others have said that they have found oil in certain areas or hydrocarbons in certain areas when they collected samples vertically. But what Rich was able to do was actually do something significantly more robust than perhaps try to connect the dots with a variety of samples or just assume that if you see oil, it is part of a plume. What we have done is much more robust in terms of ground truthing and be able to actually visually see a plume floating. But we don't know about others in terms of what would their definition of a plume is. So, you know, it's really going to be a key fact down the road when academics and other federal scientists and BP decide what is a plume versus what is just elevated amounts of, you know, hydrocarbons floating around that are levels beyond what you would expect.
Is it possible then that these plumes, however they're being defined, have been counted more than once? There was a first one that was reported northeast of the oil spill. Rich?
Okay, from what we saw, this plume that we measured, it had a southwest trend. It was moving toward the southwest at a relatively slow speed.
Then it's not possible for a plume from the northeast to come down to the southwest where your team's plume was found?
I wouldn't say it's impossible, but typically water stratifies more vertically than horizontally. So in this case, the plume that we tracked, it moved less than 50 meters in the vertical over a distance of 35 kilometers. So very stable at depth, and that is additional evidence that it's unlikely that it somehow changed altitude and course. It's what you might call a coherent plume. In other words, it was continuous and it was following the symmetry of the seafloor. It was basically constrained by the continental slope.
Yeah, I think,
Chris,
others have been talking about a plume or elevated amounts of hydrocarbons in this region where we defined the plume that we observed. So it's not to say that, you know, others may not have made measurements in the region where we found this plume. I think we want to be clear that we didn't stick a flag in this area and say that this is the, you know, first time somebody found elevated concentrations of oil in this region. I think what's more important is that we were able to constrain it and show that there was a kind of coherent and continuous plume of hydrocarbons that were flowing in this direction, which is a lot more robust than saying discrete samples in this region that were just above background.
Okay. Is there enough oxygen at depth or within this plume for microbes to be able to digest it?
What we saw in our sampling was that there was very little evidence of microbial degradation in and around this plume area. There has been some discussion about, in preliminary data, about very high amounts of oxygen, what we call drawdown, and it may be in some cases related to the technology that is used to measure oxygen. The manufacturer even says that some of these sensors that are used forming oxygen don't perform very well in the presence of oil. So they may have confounded the preliminary results. Luckily, in our case, we were able to bring a much more tried and true method for making oxygen measurements called a Winkler titration, which was developed in the 1800s, and which is significantly more robust than a sensor, and was able to show that there wasn't any significant oxygen drawdown in and around our plume, which indicates that there wasn't any microbial degradation.
Now, we've heard that the chemical dispersants have really helped in breaking up the oil to be small enough so that microbes could digest it faster and easier. That doesn't sound like it's the case here.
Well, only in the plume that we studied. I think we have to be very careful about, you know, the huge body of water in the Gulf of Mexico. I think all we can talk about right now is the measurements that we made in and around the plume as to whether or not there was any microbial degradation. you know, oil is a lot like butter to microbes. It's, you know, very high calories, but at the same time, microbes work on their own time and schedule. And, you know, we just did not sample a wide enough or comprehensive area to be able to perhaps see some activity of microbial degradation. But in the area that we did survey, we did not see.
You mentioned earlier that you were in at least some collaboration with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. To what extent does your team's report about this oil plume go along with that government report from August 4th and the now famous pie charts about where all the oil has gone? Rich?
By definition, I'm looking at the pie charts right now, and basically the way that NOAA defines it, or it's my understanding that NOAA defines there as being 8% chemically dispersed, 16% naturally dispersed, and then up to 25% evaporated or dissolved into seawater. This plume could be within any of those three pieces of the pie, so to speak, and that's anywhere between, let's see here, 62 and 36% of all the total oil. So that's a pretty big error bound. And as more information comes in, we'll be able to refine these estimates quite a bit more and hopefully get a much better understanding of not only how much of the oil is present in the subsurface, but what its eventual fate will be.
Rich Camilli and Chris Reddy, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Rich Camilli and Chris Reddy of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution are two of the authors of a paper reporting their team's track of a large continuous subsurface hydrocarbon plume in the Gulf of Mexico. Find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. Also in this week's Science, read a paper by Law and colleagues on another ocean pollutant, plastic debris, in the North Atlantic. Also in this week's Science, a new type of chlorophyll. For the first time in 60 years, scientists have isolated a new, chemically distinct variety of chlorophyll. There were four previous varieties, and Min Chin and colleagues report finding this new, fifth form of chlorophyll in a bacteria colony from Sharks Bay, Australia. This new variety is the most red-shifted chlorophyll to date, absorbing and fluorescing red light at wavelengths above 700 nanometers. The research suggests that oxygen-producing photosynthesis may be extended into the infrared range, which could have implications for bioenergy applications. Read the paper, A Red-Shifted Chlorophyll, online at www.scienceexpress.org. Major depressive disorder is an often disabling disorder. In the U.S., it afflicts about 17% of the population at some point in their lives, and many people with major depressive disorder do not respond to the first medication prescribed. And even when patients do respond to one of these antidepressants, it takes weeks or even months for the drugs to produce a therapeutic effect. Recent studies have found that a single dose of the drug ketamine can produce an antidepressant effect within hours and lasting up to a week. But scientists don't fully understand how the drug works, a drug that's not desirable for ongoing therapy because it is a drug of abuse, can produce a psychotic effect, can cause damage to brain function with long-term use, and can kill if the dose is too large. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Ron Duman and colleagues report that ketamine activates a signaling pathway in the brain called the mammalian target of rapamycin pathway, or mTOR pathway. The research suggests new therapeutic targets for antidepressant drug development. I spoke with Duman from his office at the Yale University School of Medicine.
There are two major findings, I think, of the paper. A single dose of this NMDA antagonist, ketamine, produces an increase in the number of connections in a part of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that's known to be involved in depression and treatment response. So this is really a dramatic finding that a drug can increase the connections between neurons within a relatively short time frame. And to put that into perspective, there are quite a few studies in the field that have demonstrated that stress and depression, models of depression in preclinical studies, produce the opposite effect. They actually cause atrophy of neurons and decrease the size of the dendritic or processes of neurons. So here's a drug that's able to rapidly reverse the actions of and produce the opposite actions of what is occurring with chronic stress or depression. The second major finding of the paper is related to the mechanism and the signaling pathways that underlie that effect. Ketamine can rapidly increase a signaling cascade that regulates translation of proteins at the synapse or at the contact site of neurons. And that pathway is referred to as mTOR, or mammalian target of rapamycin. So this is a pathway that's known to be involved in control of protein synthesis. It's been implicated in models of learning and memory and is required for protein synthesis-dependent long-term memory. And what we found was that ketamine is also capable of producing a rapid activation of this signaling cascade. And not only that, we also were able to demonstrate that ketamine increases levels of proteins that are involved in spine formation and spine maturation, spines being the site at which these new synapses are occurring. So ketamine is able to activate this signaling cascade, increase proteins that are important for new connections or synapses in the prefrontal cortex, this region involved in antidepressant depression responses, and thereby contribute to the antidepressant effects of ketamine.
And this was all done in rodents?
This is all done in rodents, that's right.
How did you and your team induce depression in the rodents?
So clearly studying something like depression in any psychiatric illness is difficult in rodents. But we do have behavioral tests that we've been able to characterize as having some relevance to depression. They appear to model certain aspects of depression, such as helplessness is one of the behavioral endpoints that we look at. So we're able to test whether or not ketamine can produce an antidepressant response in some of these behavioral tests that have been studied. And some of them are also characterized, or most of them are characterized, by the ability of an antidepressant to reverse the behavioral deficit that's produced. And in some of these tests, that effect of an antidepressant requires chronic treatment of weeks or even several weeks. And what we found was that ketamine, again, like in the clinical therapeutic response, is able to produce an antidepressant effect after just a single dose within 24 hours. So we were able to show that ketamine produces this rapid stimulation of mTOR signaling and rapid induction of synaptic proteins, and the rapid increase in synaptogenesis, or connections between neurons. And we think that there's a link there, and we were able to directly test that by determining whether an inhibitor of mTOR signaling, the rapamycin itself, was able to block the effects of ketamine on the synaptic proteins, on synaptogenesis, as well as on the behaviors. And in fact, that's what we were able to demonstrate, that pretreating animals with rapamycin completely block the ability of ketamine to produce the induction of synaptic proteins, the induction of synapses, and the behavioral responses in the different animal models.
Is this mTOR pathway, this mammalian target of rapamycin, conserved across all mammals, and so is the same pathway in people?
Yes, that's right. And it's not specific to this part of neurons. It's found in all parts of the brain. It's found in other tissues. And what is important here is that there's a signaling system that's regulated by ketamine that leads to selective activation, we believe, in the brain. And so we would not predict that mTOR would be activated in other tissues in the body, but only would be activated in the brain. And that's important because this signaling pathway has been implicated in cancer chemotherapy. In fact, it's an important pathway for growth of cells and growth of tumors, and is a target of cancer chemotherapy. So inhibitors of this pathway are being developed for treating cancer. So if that was the case, you wouldn't want to be activating mTOR signaling all over the body. So this effect that we see with ketamine is very specific and occurs in the brain.
And you said earlier that it increased the amount and function of neurons in the brain. Does that mean that this could possibly be a treatment for other things besides depression?
Well, that's an interesting question. It has been examined, and there's a paper that recently was published demonstrating that it is also effective for bipolar depression. There's some, I think, preliminary data, although no well-designed clinical trials yet, looking at PTSD.
Post-traumatic stress disorder.
That's right, yeah. So there is work going on to look at whether or not it's effective in other types of illnesses, and that's, I think, something that will be interesting to pursue.
But it's not as if anyone's looking at this as a means to increase or enhance brain activity.
No, certainly not. And one of the, I think, difficult aspects of understanding this compound and this class of compounds is that NMDA receptors are known to be involved and important in processes like learning and memory and synaptic plasticity. And so it's intriguing and interesting that an inhibitor of those receptors is capable of producing this rapid antidepressant response.
Do other antidepressant drugs also activate this mTOR pathway?
They do not appear to. We've examined a few different classes, the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors, the tricyclic antidepressants, and even electroconvulsive seizure, and have not observed similar effects with those other classes of antidepressants.
Is this mammalian target of rapamycin activation, the mTOR activation, both necessary and sufficient then for countering the effects of depression?
Well, at least with ketamine, it does appear to be. With this class, particular class of drugs, if you block mTOR signaling, it blocks the behavioral effects of this class of compound. We have not been able to test whether or not it's sufficient. That's a good question. We don't have a means, or at least have not tested, if we were able to directly activate mTOR signaling, independent of some of the other things that happen with ketamine, if that would be sufficient to produce an antidepressant effect. That's a good question.
So the next step then is to...
We're probably a little more interested in testing some of the other targets that have been revealed through this work, particularly regulation of some of the glutamate signaling and glutamate neurotransmission points, such as presynaptic glutamate receptors, postsynaptic glutamate receptors, some of the other downstream events that occur. Again, the problem could be with an agent that directly activated mTOR, it might have unwanted side effects in other tissues. So we're trying to think of ways to attack this in a selective way in brain to produce this effect without the unwanted side effects.
Ron Duman, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Ron Duman of Yale University School of Medicine is senior author of a paper investigating the rapid antidepressant effects of ketamine. Find the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science.
So this article is about a new kind of publishing, scientific publishing, that first started to take shape about 10 years ago.
Science's Jocelyn Kaiser reports in this week's issue on the growing trend of what's called open access scientific publishing and the arguments both for and against it.
Some prominent biologists were concerned about the fact that journals were getting more and more expensive and not everybody could afford them anymore. Libraries couldn't afford them. And they were also concerned that the public, like patients, people like that, couldn't necessarily see the articles they were interested in. They'd have to go to a library. They couldn't just go online and find them and read them. So these biologists decided to do two things. First, they got an idea going where researchers would make copies of their articles freely available within some time period, sometimes within a few months, in a free repository. And then they also started a new kind of journal, where instead of charging readers to subscribe to the journal, you would have the researchers publishing their research, the authors, pay to have their articles published, and they would be freely available the minute they were published so that anybody could read them, anybody around the world, anyone who gets on the internet. And the whole idea was to make science move faster because everybody would be able to see the research articles right away and also bring the results to the public, to patients and doctors and people besides scientists who might be interested in the results.
So you said it was paid for exclusively by the scientists who are publishing in these new kind of open access journals?
Yeah, the scientists would pay the fee, but they might take it out of their research grant, or depending on who they are getting their grant from, some private foundations have offered to pay the fees. I think it's separate from the research grant. So in some cases, they might charge it to their research grant. In other cases, they may have additional money from their agency to pay the fees.
So what, if any, reviewing is done before publication?
Well, these are peer-reviewed journals, just like traditional journals. And in both cases, the journal receives the paper and usually sends it out for review to at least a couple of scientists in the field. And then if they decide it's worth publishing, then the journal will publish it. But that part of the publishing model has not changed for scientific journals. They're still peer-reviewed journals.
So it's not like it's 100% acceptance, a pay-to-publish kind of thing.
Right. It's not 100% acceptance. But one of these new journals that has been very successful but has also been controversial, it's called PLOS One, Public Library of Science One, and it publishes 70% of submitted articles. So that's a very high acceptance rate compared to most journals. And it's also because the journal is publishing so many papers, over 7,000 papers this year, which makes it the largest journal in the world. They have become financially successful for the first time this year, and they're able to sustain a whole set of journals, including some very high rejection rate journals. And the complaint is that it's very easy to get your paper into this PLOS One journal. And the question is whether it makes sense to keep the whole publisher going by just publishing a large percentage of what comes along and charging a fee.
A concern then of quantity over quality.
Exactly.
At this point, what percentage of scientific publishing is open access?
Well, in terms of the number of journals, it's around 7% to 11% of all journals, according to various directories that track journals. The number of articles, a recent study found that 20% of articles are now freely available, but that includes both journals that make them freely available at some point, as well as repositories where a researcher can deposit either their final article or sometimes the manuscript if the journal doesn't allow them to submit the final article. Basically, these researchers just took a random sample of articles and did a Google search and tried to see if they could find the full text online and found that 20% of them, they could find it.
Is that percentage of scientific publishing that's open access really growing then?
It seems to be growing slowly. The author of that study that found that 20% of articles are now freely available projects that it's growing at something like 1% a year.
And does that growth then suggest an increasingly important role for search engine companies, for scientists as they look more and more to the internet to help them find others' research?
Yeah, I don't know how many scientists now rely on, you know, general web search to find the articles they're looking for. I think most of them will still go to the journals that are most important to them and scroll the table of contents, or they'll get article alerts. I think they won't necessarily keep up with the literature by doing Google searches, probably not.
To that, have scientists had difficulty accessing the papers they want to read under the traditional publishing model?
Well, that is another controversial point. The open access movement would say that it's become harder and harder because as the prices of journals have gone higher and higher, a lot of research libraries have had to cancel some subscriptions. And they've made the argument that if articles are freely available, you will see them be cited more often because they're easier for scientists to get to them, especially scientists who don't have access to all the articles they'd like to be able to read. But the most recent studies to look at whether open access articles are cited more often have not found that that's the case. And that suggests that researchers aren't being cut off from the articles they need.
Overall, how are traditional publishers responding to this open access trend?
I'd say they're responding in two ways. Some of the traditional, I think most of the traditional publishers probably are starting some open access journals. And they're also, a lot of them are doing what they call hybrid journals, where it's a traditional journal, but if you pay a fee, they will make just your article freely available, you know, upon publication. So they're experimenting with both of those things. But they say it's too soon to say whether open access is going to work as a business model, and they don't want to be forced to do it by funding agencies or wherever the pressure may be coming from. They say we've got to wait and see how this works first.
In your reporting, did you come across anyone who was saying that the success of open access publishing necessarily means the demise of traditional publishing?
Well, what people are worried about is that the traditional journals, it's not clear whether some of them can survive by following this open access model, but there are agencies like the National Institutes of Health that have these policies now that say, as a condition of getting a grant from us, you have to make your article freely available within 1 year in a repository. So even though these traditional journals are not, I mean, they're still subscription-based, a lot of their articles are now freely available in these repositories. if the author has NIH funding, but that's still just a fraction of all the articles the journals are publishing. And the concern is that if this really grows and if more and more of those articles become freely available, even if it's after a delay, the publishers are worried that the librarians will cancel their subscriptions and the journals will go under. So one thing that people are wondering now is, what is the future of open access? It's growing pretty slowly right now. But people who watch the field, they say that what will make a difference is if there are more agencies requiring open access or public access, if it's delayed access. And right now there's a proposal in the U.S. Congress to extend the NIH policy to 11 more research agencies, which would include, for example, the National Science Foundation. And if this became a kind of government-wide policy, that would be many more articles that would become freely available after a delay, and there would be more pressure to start more open access journals.
Are similar trends happening internationally?
Yes. In the United Kingdom, for example, the equivalent of the NIH, the Biomedical Research Council, and the Wellcome Trust, which is a big private funder of research, both have public access policies where their researchers have to make their articles publicly available after a delay. And then some other European countries, or I think quite a few probably, have similar policies. Some of their agencies do. But what people say is probably the world is not going to turn completely to open access, you know, in the next few years. Probably there's going to be both traditional journals and open access journals for at least the next couple of years.
Jocelyn Kaiser, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Science's Jocelyn Kaiser reports in this week's issue on the growing trend of open access scientific publishing and the arguments both for and against it. Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how faithfulness is evolutionarily advantageous. How so, Dave?
Well, Rob, this story is all about the evolution of selflessness. The question for evolutionary biologists for a long time has been, if we can all be selfish organisms, if I just take all the resources for myself and I don't give anything to anybody else, or if I don't help anybody else out in my community, that seems like that's the most advantageous for me genetically. And, you know, it seems like the best way for me to pass down my genes if I sort of hoard everything. So why haven't we evolved to be a lot more selfish than we are? In a lot of societies, and including bird societies, for example, members of society help other members raise their offspring. So, you know, a bird's neighbor might, you know, help it raise chicks in the nest if that bird has to go out and hunt for food or something like that. And obviously in human societies, we rely on our friends and family to help us out, especially when it comes to raising offspring. So why have we evolved to be selfless like this when it seems much more advantageous to be selfish, to not help others out, to only be concerned about yourself? And this study is really trying to get at that. And the way it's doing that is it's looking at a bunch of species of birds.
Do all species of birds help one another out in raising the offspring?
Actually, no. Some species of birds engage in what's called cooperative breeding, which means helping each other out, and some species don't.
What's the hypothesis as to why only some of them do?
Well, the idea would be that if you are related to the offspring, even if you aren't the parent, it's actually advantageous for you to help out, because the whole goal of evolution, if you can give evolution a goal, is to get your genes passed down to the next generation. And you can do that either by having your own kids or by helping out relatives, because you're going to share a lot of genes with your relatives. And if you're helping out your relatives' kids, then indirectly you're also helping some of your genes get passed down to future generations. So that's been a going theory.
And how does faithfulness then figure into this?
Well, you would imagine if you've got a very monogamous group, all the individuals are going to be very closely related to each other, because the mating is confined to a very small group of individuals, and thus all those individuals are related to each other. But if you've got a very promiscuous group of animals where, say, the male is not only mating with his partner, but he's going off and mating with other females, and those offspring are joining his family group, then all of a sudden you've got this family group where the individuals aren't as highly related to each other.
So direct siblings versus sort of half siblings.
Exactly. And the idea is, if you've got a lot of these direct siblings, then everybody's highly related to each other, and it's going to be advantageous for everybody to help everybody else out with the raising of offspring, because all of your genes are related, and therefore, even if you're not passing down your own genes, you're helping a relative pass down their genes, which are highly related to yours, versus in a more promiscuous society, if you helped out a groupmate chances are that groupmate wasn't as highly related to you, and therefore it's not as advantageous to you to help. And that's actually what the researchers saw in this study. When they looked at more promiscuous bird species and less promiscuous bird species, they saw that a much higher percentage of the faithful birds got help raising their offspring than the non-faithful birds.
And this faithfulness actually helped cooperative breeding develop over time?
Well, that's the idea. The researchers want to see, you know, is this something that actually evolved? Because that would get back to the first point we talked about the evolution of selflessness. And indeed, what the researchers found is they basically studied the evolutionary relationship between over 250 bird species, and they were looking at the direction of the breeding and who was promiscuous and who wasn't. And what they found when they analyzed all this data was that the species that grew more and more faithful over time also had more and more help raising the offspring over time. So it's not just a sort of a point in time thing. So that's really evidence that this is a behavior that's evolved, that this selflessness has evolved for a higher evolutionary purpose, and that purpose being that the more selfless you are, the more faithful you are in this case, the better it is for your offspring because you get the help raising your kids. And the people that are helping also get an advantage because they are passing some of their genes down to the next generation.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, we just talked about selflessness. Let's talk about something a lot more selfish, and that's stealing. And this next story is all about how stars steal their planet's moons.
So not actually selfishness. I mean, this is just the effects of gravity, right?
Well, basically, maybe I was anthropomorphizing these stars a little bit. But Rob, this story is all about extrasolar moons. Now, as you probably know, astronomers have identified hundreds of extrasolar planets out there. And these are planets that exist beyond our solar system. But they've yet to find an extrasolar moon, i.e. a moon orbiting one of these planets. And a new study astronomer says, hey, stop looking. It's not that we haven't found these moons. It's that they're not there.
Why not?
Well, the reason he proposes is because almost all of these extrasolar planets we found so far are called hot Jupiters. And what that means is that they're these enormous gas giant planets like our own Jupiter, and they're called hot Jupiters because they orbit very, very close to their sun. In fact, as close as Mercury orbits to our sun. So first of all, he says, you know, these planets probably did have moons once upon a time because all of our big gas giants like Jupiter and Uranus have moons. But what he's saying is our gas giants have moons because they're really far from our sun. But these hot Jupiters aren't going to have moons because in order for something to become a hot Jupiter, it forms farther out in the solar system and then migrates very close to its sun. And what the researcher did is he created this model of a gas giant just like our Jupiter, and it had four large moons just like our Jupiter has. And then he modeled this Jupiter moving very close to its parent sun. And what happened is as this planet got very close to its sun, the gravitation of the sun ripped away first three of these outermost moons and just sent them hurling into the solar system. And the fourth moon actually crashed right in to the hot Jupiter. So at least according to the simulation, this is going to happen with all the hot Jupiters out there. And therefore, even though they may have had moons in the distant past, in the state that we're finding them in now, which is orbiting very close to their parent sun, they're going to be completely moonless.
So it's not as if researchers shouldn't be looking for moons orbiting around planets. It's that they're just not going to find them around these types of hot Jupiter planets, these gas giants that are so close to their parent stars.
That's exactly right. And the problem has been that these are the planets we tend to focus on because they're the easiest ones to spot. But actually, NASA's Kepler spacecraft, which is actually designed to discover more Earth-size planets, so it doesn't have to look for these hot Jupiters like we've been looking for in the past, we'll hopefully be able to find planets a little farther out, and potentially these planets will have moons that either haven't been flung out into the solar system or collided back into them. So there's still hope yet, Rob, for finding some of these extrasolar moons.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from thieving suns to killer volcanoes, this last story is about how supermassive volcanoes may not always be the killers we make them out to be.
Who's making them out to be killers in the first place?
Well, Rob, there's been a number of very massive volcanic explosions that have rocked Earth for the past tens or hundreds of millions of years. In fact, there was a very large eruption about 250 million years ago that killed more than three-fourths of all the species on Earth, an event so catastrophic, scientists call it the Great Dying. And what these big volcanic events tend to have in common is that they are very massive, obviously, but they're also very quick. The eruption happens in such a short period of time that life doesn't really have a chance to adjust, so that anything nearby is essentially obliterated. So it's all fine and good, and it's a theory that seems to make a lot of sense. There's just one problem. There was a massive volcanic eruption about 130 to 140 million years ago that occurred in what's today southern Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay, and southwestern Africa. This is when some of the continents were more connected than they are today. And it didn't seem to cause much damage at all. It was this really massive volcano, but as far as scientists can tell, a few species disappeared from the Atlantic Ocean, and that was pretty much it.
So what was different about this eruption compared to the killer Great Dying eruption?
Well, that's a really good question, Robin. Scientists who have been researching this, and they're researching an area called the Parana Flood Basalts, and these are just these huge mountains of lava rock that stretch over more than 1 million square kilometers in this area where this eruption happened, you know, about 130 to 140 million years ago. And you can actually see a picture of some of these flood basalts on the site. But when researchers have been studying these basalts over the past few years, they've come to different conclusions. One group of researchers has said the eruption was actually very gradual. It didn't happen as quick as we thought it did. It actually happened over about 11 million years. And that would mean that eruption may not have been as catastrophic, because if it was gradual like that, life may have had a chance to adjust. But another group found that the eruption only lasted about 1 million years, which to me and you probably sounds like a very long time, but on a geological timescale, it's the blink of an eye. And so you've got these two competing conclusions out there. So what researchers did in this new study was they used a new technique that's a lot more accurate than some of the approaches that have been used in the past. And what they found is, surprisingly, that this eruption actually did happen very quickly. It took place only over about 1 million years. And that leaves a really big mystery, because if this was a big eruption, as we know it was from the size of the basalts that it left behind, and if it was a quick eruption, which geologists say is needed to extinguish tons of life, why didn't it cause a mass extinction?
So what accounts for the difference then between these two relatively quick eruptions, one that led to the Great Dying and one that didn't seem to do too much at all?
Well, geologists have a few ideas. And one idea is that it's what's on top of the volcano when it erupts. And what geologists know about the Great Dying is that the eruption that preceded it had to ascend through a bed of coal. And so you can imagine you don't just have this volcanic eruption, but you have all this coal burning. And we know from modern society that coal burning is not good for the climate and not good for the environment. So the idea is, if you've got an eruption into this very sort of toxic substance and that gets into the air and that clouds the skies, that's going to cause a lot more damage. Versus with the Parana eruption, that erupted under a desert. And you can imagine, if you're just talking about dirt and things like that and nothing very toxic, then really all you have to do is contend with the eruption itself, which, granted, is probably not very pleasant, but at least you don't have all these other factors like coal burning getting into the atmosphere. And so that's one theory. Another theory is that these volcanoes pulse when they erupt, and these are individual episodes of strong volcanic activity, and perhaps the Great Dying eruption just had a lot more of these pulses than the Parana volcano did. So the jury's still out about what made the Parana eruption so mild.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a couple of cool insect stories. We've got a story about zombie ants, and this is actually the oldest zombie ants ever found. These ants are about 50 million years old. And also a story about flies. How do flies know how high to fly? There's an interesting video that goes along with that one as well. And for Science Insider, we've got a story about the unionization of postdocs at the University of California, and also about a wish list for astronomers. What kind of telescopes and other gadgets are astronomers asking Congress for to probe the mysteries of the cosmos for the coming decades? Be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Graham is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
And that wraps up the August 20th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.